When you come into the land, I will say, and you'll say, if you want a king, you will surely set a king over thee whom the Lord thy God shall choose, one from among thy brethren. And then it says, such a king shall not multiply horses. Verse 16. Verse 17, he shall not multiply wives. He will write out a copy of the law and live out of that. He'll learn the law and live by it and that sort of thing. Kenneth says, chapter 17 could not have been written when a king was on the throne, but only when there was probability that one would be elected, and it was necessary to insist that certain things be adhered to. But someone wouldn't write a thing like Deuteronomy 17 while the king is already there. So, he says you have to get a time when there is no king, but there's a probability that one is going to be elected or selected. And interestingly enough, one of the qualifications of the king is that he must be an Israelite. Verse 15, when thou shalt set a king over thee, whom the Lord thy God shall choose, one from among thy brethren shalt thou set king over thee. Thou mayest not set a foreigner over thee, who is not thy brother. Well, when would such a situation be in existence, when there'd even be the thought of setting someone as a king over the people of Israel, who might not have been an Israelite? Well, he thinks that you have to go to post-exilic time to find a situation that accounts for that. Of course, I think the question can immediately be raised, why not go to pre-monarchic times, shortly after the exodus out of Egypt, when you had a mixed multitude? But in any case, here's a man in 1920 trying to push Deuteronomy instead of back toward Moses, the other direction, into post-exilic time. And he writes a book and develops a library theory for that. Another man, G. Holscher, H-O-L-S-C-H-E-R, 1922. Similar idea to Kenneth. He set out to prove that the book of Deuteronomy had no relationship with the law book of Josiah, but was at least 100 years after the time of Josiah. So again, we're down in the 500s. He says that to demand a single sanctuary in pre-exilic times would have been a piece of impractical idealism. Now, he's assuming that Deuteronomy demands a central sanctuary, and to do such would have been a piece of impractical idealism in pre-exilic times. He says, how could the entire population of the country journey to Jerusalem for a whole week at festival time, leaving farm animals to fend for themselves, and that sort of thing? It's very impractical to demand centralization of worship, and to then place Deuteronomy chapter 12 in a pre-exilic period of time is just impractical. He says that Deuteronomy was not a program for reform, but the wishful thinking of unrealistic post-exilic dreamers. It was not a program for reform, but the wishful thinking of unrealistic post-exilic dreamers. This is what they'd like things to be. It's not something that ever was or ever could be. So he felt that it was written sometime in the 500s, probably around 500 BC, by priests in Jerusalem, which is quite a different position from Wellhausen, because interestingly enough, Wellhausen felt there was a prophetic background to the book of Deuteronomy, not priestly, but prophetic, and that the ideas and motifs that you find in Deuteronomy were the result of prophetic influence, not priestly influence. So, Holscher places it in the exilic time, feels it's this impractical sort of program of a priestly circle in Jerusalem, opposed to Philistine. All right, secondly, under challenges to the classic Wellhausen position, advocates is of a date earlier than 621, but later than the beginning of the monarchy. Earlier than 621, but later than the beginning of the monarchy. In other words, earlier in 621, but not going back to Moses. Several names here. A. H. Ewald.
E-W-A-L-D.
H. Ewald.
Way back in 1876.
Placed the origin of Deuteronomy in the reign of Manasseh. Now, Manasseh was followed by Ammon, Ammon by Josiah. So you move back, not significantly, but two kings earlier. He placed the origin book in the time of the reign of Manasseh. A. Westfall.
W-E-S-T-P-H-A-L,
1910. Argued that Deuteronomy alone could inspire a reformation like that conceived and outlined by Hezekiah. Now, Hezekiah was the king before Manasseh, so he moved back another king. What was behind Hezekiah's reformation? Well, Deuteronomy must have been present in the time of Hezekiah. So he placed the Argent book in the time of Hezekiah.
And then T.H. Oefreger, O-E-S-T-R-E-I-C-H-E-R, O-E-S-T-R-E-I-C-H-E-R.
Theodore Oefreger, 1923. Argued for a date earlier than Hezekiah. Perhaps as early as the 10th century. Sometime in the 900s. In other words, you're getting back right to the, close to the beginning of the kingdom period. Oestreicher rejected the idea that either Josiah's reform or the book of Deuteronomy demanded centralization of worship. Now, that was a basic thesis of Wellhausen. Josiah's law book and Deuteronomy demand centralization of worship. Oestreicher rejects that idea. Two terms that Oestreicher used have become rather well known in discussions around Deuteronomy. I'll give you those terms. In his view, the reform of Josiah was concerned with cult reinheit.
Now, that's a German word, cult. You can, just like the English word, C-U-L-T, it's spelled with a K, cult. Reinheit is purity. So it's concerned with cultic purity. Cultic in the sense of external religious observance and worship.
Purity of worship. Deuteronomy is concerned with cult reinheit, not
cult einheit. Now, einheit is unity. Not cultic unity in the sense of centralization of worship.
In other words, his view was that Josiah's reform was more concerned with purity of worship rather than unity of worship at a central sanctuary. He points out that Josiah had begun his reformation on his own initiative several years before the law book was found. So even if you conclude that that law book was Deuteronomy, which may well be the case, the finding of that law book did not initiate the reform, but gave a new impetus to a reform that had already been begun. So he sort of challenged Wellhausen's view of identifying that law book with Deuteronomy. He challenged Wellhausen's view that the book called for centralization of worship, and felt that Deuteronomy itself stemmed from a much earlier time, but that Deuteronomy did not, in any exclusive sense, demand centralization of worship. But it did emphasize purity of worship.
Does this strike you as kind of unusual that he should take as a point of argument something that the Bible actually says?
Well, I see the reason for your question, yeah, because frequently with something like that doesn't fit with the theory, then it's explained as being a later insertion or some misrepresentation, so he isn't taken seriously. But I think you could say maybe Oesterreicher here is trying to take that record of the size of Reformation seriously, work out the implications of that, and even take Deuteronomy seriously to a certain extent, but still probably feeling that the differences between, say, the covenant code, the Deuteronomic code, and the priesthood code require some kind of an explanation other than that they're all Mosaic. Yeah. Capital D, Adam C. Welsh.
A.C. Welsh, W-E-L-C-H.
Two books, 1924 and 1932.
A great deal of time on Deuteronomy,
Adam C. Welsh. One book, 24 book, was The Code of Deuteronomy. The 1932 book, entitled Deuteronomy, The Framework to the Code. He came pretty much independently of Oesterreicher to the same conclusion concerning centralization of worship. In other words, he did not feel that a basic thesis of Deuteronomy was to insist on centralization of worship. However, his reasoning was slightly different, coming to the same conclusion. He felt that Deuteronomy 12:1-7, which is one of the crucial passages concerning centralization, was a later insertion. So, we'll have to look at Deuteronomy 12:1-7. Eventually, just to see what we think about this matter. Does it demand centralization work? Doesn't it demand centralization work? How does that relate to Wellhausen's theory? Welsh says the book as a whole doesn't emphasize that. Perhaps 12:1-7 does, but that's a later insertion. It wasn't original. And he felt the emphasis of the book was on the character of the places of worship, not the number. In other words, that's close to this cultic purity, not cultic unity stress. He concluded that the book contains material originating in northern Israel from the time of Samuel on. So we're getting back earlier, you see, in the time of Samuel. It's pre-monarchy. It contains material that dates back that far, but that the present form that we have it in is no earlier than the 8th century BC. In other words, he goes back another century before Josiah, but no further than that. In other words, there's a period of development, process of transmission coming into the form that we have it in now. Lastly, Gerhard von Rod. Done an enormous amount of work with Deuteronomy. as well as, of course, with many other areas of Old Testament study. Bunrod is one of probably the two or three most influential, I was going to say contemporary Old Testament scholars. He died just a few years ago, so he's no longer living, but a lot of his work is very recent. And certainly enormously influential. I'll mention three works of his that deal directly with Deuteronomy. First, an article entitled The Problem of the Hexateuch, written in 1938. The Problem of the Hexateuch, 1938. That is available in English translation in this book, The Problem of the Hexateuch and Other Essays. Gerhard von Rob. The collection of articles in this book, the first and largest article is this one, The Problem of the Hexateuch. Second book, Studies in Deuteronomy. Small paperback published in English translation in 1953. In German, it was originally published in 1948. Studies in Deuteronomy. And then a commentary of Deuteronomy. German edition 1964, English translation 1966. Deuteronomy, Gerhard von Rob. What he tried to do, which is really sort of a distinctive move out of this tradition of literary critical investigation, trying to analyze the book in a literary critical framework, was to approach the book from the form critical method. And what attracted his attention, as far as Deuteronomy was concerned, was its structure, the total structure of the book. Going way back to this Problem of the Hexateuch article, 1938, page 26 and 27 in this English translation, he says this, very interesting. We may leave aside the many difficulties currently raised by the problem of Deuteronomy and confine ourselves to a matter which has as yet scarcely been touched on by scholars, despite all the controversy about the nature of the book. What are we to say about the form of Deuteronomy, with its remarkable succession of speeches and laws and so on? Even if it be thought that Deuteronomy in its present guise comes straight from the theologian's desk, this does not prevent our asking what genre it belongs to. Genre, what literary form? The total structure of the book. It simply drives the question further back, compels us to look into the history and development of the form of the material used by the Deuteronomic theologians. One cannot accept the assumption that these men created ad hoc so remarkable a literary form. Now, he discusses the total structure of the book from the viewpoint of what kind of a genre is involved in this book. What is the origin of that? And what implications then does that have for state? Where did it come from? He says, one might be forgiven for imagining the Deuteronomists seated at their desks, hunting round for a diversity of forms into which they could pour a new content, and striving by the most effective combination of various elements to give expression to their special theological interests. Obviously, from the point of view of form criticism, no one would accept any such picture of the origins of Deuteronomy. It is precluded by a recognition of the fact, and this is something totally new in Deuteronomic studies, in the critical tradition up to this point, it is precluded by recognition of the fact that Deuteronomy is, in form, an organic whole. In other words, von Rod starts speaking of the unity of the book. It's an organic whole. We may distinguish any number of different strata and accretion by literary criteria. In other words, he doesn't discard this literary critical method. He says there's still levels of material, earlier material, later material. But in the matter of form, the various constituents form an indivisible unity. The question is thus inescapably raised of the origin and purpose of the form of Deuteronomy, as we now have it. He then says, we've got a form that gives a unity to the book. What's the origin of the form? 1938, he says the book falls structurally into four sections. Let me give these to you and take them down. Four sections. Number one, historical presentation of the events at Sinai. Historical presentation of the events at Sinai. And paranetic material connected with these events.
Now that term he uses a lot. P-A-R-A-N-E-T-I-C.
Paranetic material connected with it. That is material that has the characteristic of exhortation, preaching, exhortation. So that's Deuteronomy 1-11. Historical summary of events at Sinai. Paranetic material connected with those events. Chapters 1-11. Two, the reading of the law.
12-26.
Two, the reading of the law. 12-26. In other words, you get all the legal material in that central section. 12-26. Thirdly, the sealing of the covenant. Deuteronomy 26, verses 16 to 19. 26, 16 to 19. The sealing of the covenant. And then fourthly, blessings and curses. Chapter 27 and following. So four basic sections as far as structure is concerned. He says that in form the book's an organic whole.
Let me take the question again. Before we mention the structure.
I don't know what I may have said there. If you recognize this structure and this form, what situation in life may have produced that form? Where does it come from? What is the explanation for this remarkable form that's found in the book? He says it's not some ad hoc creation of some Deuteronomist sitting down at his desk. It's got something more to it than that. So he wants to try to press back and find some explanation for this form that he sees. In his commentary, which is much later, you see that problem of Hexateuch is 1938. He has this little book, Studies of Deuteronomy, in the 40s and early 50s, English translation. 64, 10 years ago, 66 in English translation. His commentary on Deuteronomy. Page 12, he says this. Deuteronomy shows a remarkable arrangement. A predominantly hortatory speech to the people, exhortation, that's a paranetic type of material, passes in Deuteronomy 12 into a recital of the law. This part ends in Deuteronomy 26, 16 to 19 with the formulation of the covenant. Then there follows again in elaborate detail the proclamation of blessing and curse, that's a fourfold structure. This arrangement certainly cannot be explained as due to literary considerations. On the contrary, we must suppose that Deuteronomy is here following a traditional cultic pattern, probably that of the liturgy of a cultic festival. Now that is his basic idea, that the explanation for this form is to be found in a cultic liturgy that had been extant in Israel. And the form of that cultic liturgy has been adopted here in the book of Deuteronomy. So he says, bottom of page 12, we will content ourselves with the statement that Deuteronomy presents itself to us almost as a mosaic of innumerable, extremely varied pieces of traditional material. There are all these different kinds of material in it, from all different kinds of times. But at the same time, this is not to deny that the book must nevertheless, in the last resort, be understood as a unity. And the unity to the book is supplied by this unique form, which he feels has its origin in some sort of a cultic liturgy. Now, von Rad then views the book as the final product of a long, complex process of development. And he regards its structure as evidence that the origins of this material are to be found in a covenant renewal festival held periodically in Shechem in pre-monarchic times. Now, Shechem, remember, it's down in the north of Israel, at which a covenant renewal ceremony very clearly was held and described as contained in Joshua chapter 24, at the point of the death of Joshua after Israel come into the land. There was that call of all Israel to come to Shechem at the point of Joshua's death. They renewed their allegiance to the Lord at the point of transition in leadership. Well, he felt that these covenantal traditions had their root there at that site, that sanctuary in Shechem, and that they were preserved there, and that they were passed down from early days of Israel's occupation of the land and gradually enlarged upon and ultimately we get the material from that Shechem sanctuary preserved for us in what we have presently in the book of Deuteronomy. Well, what's the intermediate link between what we have now and what